Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Throughout these podcast episodes, we will speak to a range of individuals about their experience of eating disorders, with the aim of increasing awareness and understanding whilst reducing stigma and isolation. Please note that the topics discussed in this podcast may be triggering for some individuals, so tread lightly, check in with yourself and reflect on these conversations.
Oh, well, Chloe, it's so nice to have you on the podcast. Did you get in contact with me?
Yeah.
I honestly can't remember how we initially started chatting.
I think I came across you on Instagram, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, amazing. Well, thank you so much for joining me. For the listeners, did you want to just introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, so I'm Chloe. I'm 27 years old. I'm a nurse and I work in a GP surgery, and I have a real passion for mental health and eating disorders with my own lived experience, but also, as we'll discuss, about chronic health conditions. I have a fair few of those. That's me.
Amazing. I don't think I realized you were a nurse, so that's exciting to find out.
It's
really interesting because I don't know whether this is maybe naivety or what have you, but it feels as though the term chronic conditions, especially since COVID, is being used a lot more. But also, you know, when someone says like a chronic condition, I suppose that is an umbrella term for different conditions. And you said you've got quite a few.
Yeah.
If you don't mind sharing, would you like want to tell us a bit more about your different conditions?
Yeah, so for me, I have something called hypermobility spectrum disorder, which is sometimes referred to as HSD. And I kind of view that as an umbrella to many of the other conditions I have. So although that diagnosis didn't come first, it's made a lot of my health make sense. So as a result of the hypermobility spectrum disorder, I have chronic migraines, I have fibromyalgia, I have Raynaud's, I have mast cell activation, which is where the body kind of views it can be things that you eat or other allergens that you come into contact with as kind of a lot more dangerous than they are. And you kind of have a really heightened response to those. I have chronic fatigue syndrome. So that diagnosis actually came first. And that was after I'd had a virus. Don't know what it was, never really got to the bottom of what it was. It was around COVID time, but I don't think it was COVID. But anyway, it was following that virus that it all kind of started unraveling. Things got quite complex. But yeah, chronic fatigue came first. Mm-hmm. And then I've kind of had to put the puzzle pieces together.
Yeah. Random tangent. I mean, I guess it's not random tangent, but it's interesting what you said about hypermobility. I was at the eating disorder medical students conference last week, and one of the speakers actually spoke about her experience of hypermobility, and she used a phrase that honestly, like, I think is one of the best phrases I've ever heard in my life in terms of medical conditions. If you can't connect the issues, think connective tissues. And I was like, that's amazing.
That's good.
Because very in a similar sense to you, she had quite a few different conditions.
Yep.
And nobody had ever really been able to draw parallels or what have you. But then she realized down the line that she had, that she was hypermobile. And I think as well, there's actually, I don't know whether you know anything about this, but there's quite a lot of research coming out about the link between hypermobility, eating disorders, and then also neurodivergence.
Yeah, I am aware of that. And yeah, like interestingly, recently got diagnosed with ADHD myself. So yeah, there is a huge link. Yeah.
Wow. Do you know, or does the research know, or I guess it's, I think from my perspective, the way that people are talking about it, it feels like quite a recent realization about what is the connection or why there is a connection
with regards to the like neurodivergent element? I don't know, but I have read things around the hypermobility and eating disorders. And I think, put in kind of simple terms, what I understand from what I've read is that it's almost like your connective tissue isn't kind of holding how it should be. It's not working as it would in somebody that's not hypermobile. And it's kind of like how, even down to things like how you perceive your own body with hypermobility may not be what other people would perceive it as. Kind of the body dysmorphia type stuff, I think, comes in there. And I think just maybe the communication between like parts of your body and your brain maybe just aren't quite what they should be. But yeah, definitely not an expert on that by any means, but that's what I understand by it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like, because I've spoken to several people now that have either, like yourself, got lived experience of that, or they're doing research of it. And it sounds like, you know, it's becoming something people are more and more aware of.
Yeah.
And I guess that's maybe why more people are being diagnosed with the different elements, because there is that awareness.
Yeah.
But when you were speaking there as well of kind of like, you know, I guess with the connective tissues, your body not feeling how it should, I was also thinking about maybe the fact of, and whether it's like a chicken and egg situation, isn't it? But if you have, you know, issues with hypermobility and then all of these other chronic conditions, that I imagine if you haven't got an answer for it,
yeah,
can leave you feeling quite like out of control and like, I just don't know what's going
100%.
On. 100%. Which I think we know is kind of, a, you know, the time when an eating disorder is like, hi, I can help.
100%. I can provide the answer. Yeah, yeah. And I can relate to that massively because I'm what, 27, nearly 28 years old, and it's only within the past, even really the last 12 months, that I've kind of got real answers. Didn't have the hypermobility spectrum disorder diagnosis. I mean, I had the migraines, the chronic fatigue, but it just didn't make sense. Like, the pieces weren't put together, and it still doesn't necessarily feel that way. Like, the puzzle still feels jumbled, but it feels clearer. And I think living with kind of ongoing like pain and the fatigue and just these symptoms that you know are not normal and like the GP can't seem to get on top of, yeah, it does. It makes you feel like, you know, and you start to question, is there actually anything wrong with me? You know, if someone can't put a label to it or somebody can't identify what's going on for you. I was like, well, am I imagining all this? And I wasn't. I definitely wasn't. But yeah, the gaslighting definitely comes in.
Yeah.
And I think the complexity of it all makes it so hard for even the professionals to understand because, yeah, you know, I'm under so many different specialists and I seem to have to be the one to put it all together. You almost need to sit in a room with everybody like in charge of your care and be like, let's all talk to each other. And I mean, they send letters, don't they? But it's not the same. And, you know, they don't all understand each other's part. So I'm then left trying to be like, okay, so this might then mean that. And then this might mean that. But yeah, tiring.
Yeah. Yeah, I can imagine that is extremely tiring. And also, I don't know, because I've thought about this in different aspects, maybe not with like the specific things that you're talking about, like chronic conditions, but you know, if someone presents with an eating disorder and then we know that they've got comorbid depression or something like that, you know, you would, I don't know whether I'm being asking for too much here, but I would think that the teams talking to each other would be quite an important part of your care, because like if you're struggling, let's say, with an eating disorder, but you've also got hypermobility, but then, you know, lots of other things, they're surely going to have an impact on each other. 100%. And actually coming together and using everyone's expertise seems like a logical approach to me.
Yeah. And unfortunately, in my personal experience, it doesn't or hasn't really happened for me. I mean, one of the specialists I'm under is gastro. I have lots of digestive issues, which is probably down to the hypermobility. The connective tissue in my bowel isn't working as it should, and the signals aren't working how they should. And that has had a huge impact on the ED and my recovery with that. And I think one of the reasons for my most recent relapse were my gastro issues. And yeah, they don't talk to each other. Gastro didn't talk to the ED team. And all the letters are kind of sent to the GP. And my GP is amazing and tries to coordinate it all as best as she can. But she's a GP. She's not a specialist in eating disorders or gastro. So yeah, unfortunately, it's not there, which is a real shame. And I think myself quite lucky being a nurse. I do have quite a lot of understanding of medical jargon and my conditions. However, I know that's not the reality for a lot of people who suffer with, you know, lots of stuff alongside an ED. So yeah, there's definitely something missing, but we could say that about quite a few things in the NHS, I think.
Potentially, maybe we could, I think we could record a whole podcast series, let alone podcast episode.
Definitely.
On that. And I do think, you know, it's, like you say, it's, I feel similar to you in that, you know, when I had my relapse, because of the background that I have within mental health, I felt lucky in the fact that I had knowledge about the health condition that I was going through, and also the ability, because of my research background, to go and research it further.
Yeah.
However, one, not everybody has that, and two, I don't think that that should be your responsibility to do that. It should be the medical professionals to coordinate your care. But I'm just interested, you mentioned like your most recent relapse and that the gastro issues maybe have been a trigger for that, and I wondered maybe if you wanted to expand a bit more on, you know, what your experience had been and then how that led to the like eating disorder being triggered.
Yeah, absolutely. So with regards to like my gastro stuff, I was diagnosed with IBS like a long, long time ago, probably when I was like 17 or something like that. And sometimes the symptoms I have are debilitating. Like I can have pain that is just like, I can't do anything. Like I can't move. At one point they thought I had endometriosis. I had surgery to investigate and they didn't find it. And it all links to, I now know it all links to my gastro stuff. And yeah, I have pain. I have like extreme bloating, which again would then link in with, I feel fat, the ED gets loud, and the kind of body dysmorphia. Yeah, I mean, the symptoms are so extreme, and I feel like lots of people say I have IBS, or like IBS is really common these days, and it's like it can be so, so debilitating. And I think when you have such extreme pain and you feel really bloated, you, for me, I didn't feel hungry, like zero appetite whatsoever, not hungry, like it could physically hurt me to actually eat. So yeah, you know what eating disorders are like you give them an inch, they take a mile. So a couple of days and I'm like not hungry, just like not going to eat very much. And then like the eating disorder can just very much run with that. And yeah, it's really lonely and it's really isolating because I didn't really have anybody to talk to that understood actually what I was going through. So yeah, kind of, it's looking at the bigger picture, in my opinion, and not just kind of, oh, she's relapsed with her eating disorder because she has a history of anorexia. Mm. Actually, let's look at what's going on in a wider health picture and look at all the different systems, because, you know, body and mind are connected. It's not an isolated thing. Let's look at the whole thing. And yeah, I mean, I identified that the gastro stuff was a lot of the relapse, a lot of the reason. Yeah, and I kind of had clinicians say to me, oh, that sounds really hard. And I'm like, yeah, it is. Like, help me with that. Like, I'm trying my best, and it's clearly at this point in time, my best isn't quite working and I'm not in a healthy place. So, yeah, I think just having to advocate for yourself constantly with it is just, yeah, it's exhausting. But yeah.
And I think the difficulty is there that, so I have had anorexia as well. And through the anorexia experience. I mean, what you're saying to me sounds extremely similar to what I experience. So I'm probably going to take this away and do a little, because obviously I have ADHD and eating disorder as well. So I'm joining the dots as we speak. But yeah, the behaviours of the eating disorder, particularly with anorexia, you know, the restriction and stuff, that then causes such bad gastrointestinal problems anyway. And then when you're weight restoring and you're having to eat more and stuff. So I think that there's a massive misunderstanding around IBS. I'm saying that in quote marks, because it's, you know, it's IBS, it's a symptom. Mm. It's not actually a diagnosis. And I think often, you know, I would say to my partner, oh, I'm really struggling with my IBS today. Yep. And because it's such a range of things, it can be from like a little bit of bloating to, like you say, like chronically uncomfortable pain. And, you know, I think back to a few months ago where I was weight restoring every single night, I was going to bed with like, you know, a weighted blanket on my tummy, hot water bottles, anything to just soothe that pain a bit. Yeah. And I think people don't understand, it's not just a bit of a tummy ache or a little bit of bloating. It is like a chronic pain. And also when you're going through something that, you know, you're absolutely terrified of gaining weight anyway, and then every time you look in the mirror, you're bloated or your clothes feel tighter or everything like that, it just, it exasperates that problem so much. And I think, for me, definitely in my experience, that was something that was so misunderstood as part of my recovery, was the like detrimental impact that was having on me. And actually now that I've kind of reached a stable weight and, you know, regular eating and stuff, I'm not as bloated. Mm. And that has helped my mental health so much. So it's like a horrible cycle of, you know, you're trying to do good for your eating disorder, but then, you know, other things come into play that make it even trickier. And if there was an understanding of that within the medical team, they'd then be able to kind of help you through those different things.
Definitely. And yeah, I think the time kind of constraints that, you know, people in the NHS are under, you know, is a massive part of it. But I think it's just about really listening to the person in front of you or the person on the phone, however kind of consultations take place, and kind of just looking at the wider picture and being curious about that, rather than being like, oh, okay, you get bloated, you know, you've got IBS. It's kind of like, yeah, but actually that could be like life-threatening for somebody if that then triggers their anorexia and they go into like a full-blown relapse. So yeah.
I remember when I think it was like in between relapses, but I still wasn't doing great. And I went to the doctor to talk about the IBS for some help. And they suggested the low FODMAP diet.
Yes. And I was like, that recommendation too. Yeah.
And I was like, I'm in recovery from anorexia, you know, very restrictive eating disorder. Is that a good idea? And also, you know, you're supposed to do that under the supervision of like a dietitian or a nutritionist. They were just going to let me go willy-nilly. And I was just like, oh, okay, I'm just going to highlight to you that that's not a good idea.
Absolutely. And I mean, I had that experience a few weeks ago, and I was seeing a cardiologist. I wasn't even seeing a gastro consultant at this particular appointment. And he looked at my notes. At least he read my notes. I mean, that's a plus. But he said, we really need to get your gastro stuff under control. And I was like, I'm not here for gastro. Like, I'm here for cardiology and I'm, you know, a potential diagnosis. And he said, you know, you need to start eliminating food from your diet and seeing what triggers you. And I just sat there and was like, I've just told you that I was discharged from the NHS Eating Disorder Service yesterday. And yeah, and he was like, oh yeah, like didn't make the connection, join the dots, didn't kind of consider that what he'd said was maybe inappropriate. And I guess it's just a lack of awareness and understanding on his part potentially. Yeah. And fortunately, I was in a position to know that's not going to happen for me. That's not ideal. And I wasn't affected by that, but somebody in a really, you know, vulnerable position or someone that's unwell at that time, they could take that and run and be like, a healthcare professional has told me I can start restricting things from my diet. And it is worrying. And as I said, I'm thankful that I was able to kind of see the comment for what it was and know that that wasn't appropriate for me. But yeah, it just makes you wonder, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't know about you, but whenever I go to see a healthcare professional now, and there is always a comment that I'm like, oh, well, that wasn't very helpful for the fact that I've just told you that I'm recovering from eating disorder, but that's okay. We'll move on. But I feel so grateful, and it sounds maybe as you're in a similar situation of that, I've reached a point where I, you know, can be bold enough to actually say, you know, just for future reference, somebody with an eating disorder probably shouldn't do that. And then hopefully that can help them. But I do think, you know, the amount of vulnerable people, like you say, that would say, oh, well, the doctors told me I need to do the low FODMAP diet, yeah. Which is, you know, I think when you're unfortunately struggling with anorexia, it's kind of, if there's any excuse to get away from certain types of food. And I remember someone saying to me, actually, which blew my mind, they were like, oh, well, it's all right for people with eating disorders to do, because it's like fruits and vegetables. So, you know, normally they wouldn't restrict them.
Yes, like, I have also had,
can you hear?
I've also had that experience. Yeah. Yeah, well, it might work quite well for you. I've had someone say it might work quite well for you because it's actually really healthy. And I was like, no, you're not quite understanding.
You've missed the mark.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, hopefully someone's listening to this and they will hear us giggling and they will know not to recommend low FODMAP diets to people with eating disorders, or in fact anybody if they're not getting the support of a nutritionist.
Yes.
And the other thing that I wanted to ask you about, because I think we spoke about this a little bit when we were chatting, with the chronic fatigue, how that kind of impacted your eating disorder and I guess the cognitions that you had around eating and exercise as well.
Yep. So with the chronic fatigue, one thing that I really have noticed with the impact with the ED is sleeping a lot, needing to rest more than your average person, and moving around probably a fair bit less. I mean, I would often, or still often, like, will sleep through meal times or snack times or a time when I know I should be eating. And yeah, I mean, I thankfully am currently in recovery. I'm doing really well. Regular eating is happening for me. But if I need to sleep, I need to sleep. And the food has to kind of move around that, which can be tough, especially in the early stages, where I guess that rigidity is quite good, knowing when your kind of food is coming. But yeah, I mean, needing to rest and kind of having to prioritize that at times. I think as well, not moving so much and resting more means that A, my appetite again is affected, like with the gastro stuff, but bearing in mind, if I'm not moving around much in the day, like, my body isn't or doesn't always feel hungry. And the eating disorder can kind of run away with that and be like, well, you're not hungry, therefore you don't need to eat, or you haven't moved, therefore you haven't earned your food, or, you know, and I know, healthy Chloe knows that you don't need to earn your food. That's not a thing. Just existing is enough to earn your food, you know. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think it's the needing to sleep more. It's the thoughts that come up around the inactivity. And I mean, you can get into such a cycle with it, because if I'm not in a good place and, you know, I'm missing meals and I'm sleeping through meals, mentally I'm not on top form because my brain isn't receiving the fuel that it needs to think rationally and make healthy decisions. So yeah, I have to really like monitor it and kind of keep checking in with myself. You know, am I going to sleep because I'm tired and I need to rest, or am I going to sleep because the ED is loud and I want to miss X kind of meal or snack? So yeah, thankfully in a really good place at the moment with the eating disorder, but something I just have to be really aware of. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's such a good point of, like, I guess being hypervigilant around those thoughts and things, because I found, I mean, and this is unrelated to kind of, I guess, you know, your angle of chronic fatigue. But when I was on holiday, for example, like my hunger and the signals and stuff were different to what they are at home. And I don't know whether you find the same thing, but I find if I, you know, if, let's say Joe Bloggs, who hasn't struggled from an eating disorder, they can skip breakfast and they might just be more hungry at lunchtime, so they'll have a slightly larger lunch, or they might not be, but over time it doesn't really matter because they have a good relationship with food, which means that they'll find balance. But I, on when we were on holiday, there would be a couple of times where like we would wake up late, or like it just, you know, I wasn't in my routine that I'm in at home, and so I might miss something. And I found that missing one thing was then like, oh well, you missed that.
Yeah,
you could go miss something later, and it almost became like a downward spiral. So I had to be so conscious, and that, I'm not gonna lie, really annoyed me, because I was like, no, I'm in recovery, I should be able to, like, you know, change things up a bit. But actually, I think you're so right in that you do have to be, you know, I think I've now realized as an individual, and I don't know whether this will change in the future or not, but for now, like, I am in a place where skipping might be okay for some people, but it's not okay for me. But that, like you say, is so hard if you're having to prioritize your sleep and your rest,
yeah,
because you're feeling so tired and actually not able to. It's then how you make up for that, you know, when you are awake and when you are up and about.
Definitely. And I can relate to kind of when routine changes, and maybe, you know, you're at a hotel and you've had a buffet breakfast because that's what's available, and then you know that you're having like a big buffet dinner at the restaurant at the hotel, and it's kind of like lunchtime might not really be lunchtime, it might be like a snack rather than lunch. And as you say, people without eating disorders might not even think twice, and they're like, this is just, you know, I'm listening to my body and I'm not really hungry for a big lunch, so I'm just gonna have whatever. But yeah, for people in recovery, that might be kind of dangerous territory, or the thoughts that kind of are provoked from that might be unhealthy. And I guess intuitive eating, that kind of term comes up for me, and it's like, you know, when will I reach a stage where I can eat intuitively and actually, you know, not have to think about a meal plan or the set things I need to eat every day? Seems like a real nice thing to have, but yeah, maybe with time we get there. Yeah.
It's interesting, actually, the podcast that I recorded last week with a lady called Judith, she's a big advocate of intuitive eating, and I had a similar question of like, how the hell am I ever going to get to a point where I can eat intuitively? Because if I've in the past ever tried intuitive eating, it was just my eating disorder, because I'm just like, oh no, I'm not hungry right now, so I don't need to eat. And she, you know, said, well, that's not intuitive eating to start with. But also her answer was kind of, you get to a point of intuitive eating when you're not thinking about intuitive eating anymore. Like, if you're thinking, I'm going to actively start intuitive eating, you're probably going to diet, or you're going to like engage in eating some behaviors. But intuitive eating, part of it is that you're not thinking about the act of intuitive eating. You're just responding when you're hungry or when you're full.
Yeah.
You don't kind of have that extended thought, which I thought was really interesting, because I have tried, again in quote marks, intuitive eating quite a lot, and it's just led to,
yeah,
you know, symptoms that reflect my eating disorder.
Definitely. And that is really interesting, and I think a lot of it comes down to trusting our bodies and our signals and our hunger cues. And actually, lots of people, well, for me with my eating disorder, I know that for such a long time I haven't listened to my body, and actually, yeah, I'm not going to reach a place of intuitive eating if I'm not doing that. Like, we need to be in tune with our bodies and actually trusting, and not just trusting when it feels okay, but trusting when the hunger might be really extreme and that feels really uncomfortable, but we need to trust that and actually go with that, rather than just trusting, oh, I'm not actually hungry, because that's the eating disorder, if you're only going to listen to part of it, you know?
Yeah. Something's just come into my head, and I hope you don't mind me asking this, but I guess I'm just inquisitive. You just spoke about like trusting your body and stuff, and I just wonder, if have you kind of, I don't know how to phrase this. Do you think your ability to trust your body has been affected because of the chronic conditions?
Really good question. And yes, absolutely. There are times where the way that my mind kind of thinks and feels about my chronic conditions is my body is broken or my body doesn't work properly. So yeah, then putting trust in my body does feel really, really difficult because I'm like, I'm 27 years old and I struggle to do lots of things that people my age would do without thinking twice. I'm meant to trust my hunger cues. Like, what? So yeah, definitely something that I've kind of taken time to think about and reflect on. And yeah, it's really hard to kind of trust and have that self-compassion for my body when I think about the amount of like distress and pain and kind of grief I feel because it doesn't necessarily work how I wish it would. Yeah.
I think, I didn't want to put those words exactly, but I think it makes sense, doesn't it? Particularly from what it sounds like with what's happened with you, in that it wasn't something that you've always had. It's something that's developed over time and there's been changes. And I can imagine adapting to that alongside also recovering from an eating disorder is quite difficult, of knowing, you know, what here is the chronic condition and what is the eating disorder? How am I meant to separate them and actually, you know, lean into one and be supportive to one and then actually kind of, you know, try and step away from the other?
Definitely they overlap hugely. And I think like, for example, when I was last in treatment in a treatment center, and you know, you're plated up your food and your portions and all the rest of it, and you have very little control over that for obvious reasons. And you know, it would get to dinner and I would just be sat there like, I physically can't eat anymore, I'm in pain. And then the like members of staff would come over and be like, it's your eating disorder talking, like, you know, this is a normal amount of food to eat at this time of the day, you know, you're just not used to it because you've perhaps been restricting. And actually I would question myself and I think, mm-hmm. I am in pain, but is it really pain? Because I should be able to eat this amount of food. So the overlap, yeah, is huge in some areas. I mean, with the fatigue and not knowing, is that because of restriction or is that because, I mean, it was probably a combination of both when I was actively restricting, but yeah, the overlap just really makes it more complicated, and it's complicated already. But we just add another layer of complexity when you've got to kind of really try and work out. And I think sometimes it's actually not about trying to work it out and focusing too much. And it's kind of just getting through the best way you can. But yeah, the overlap of it all just, yeah, it's a lot. It is a lot. And there's not really like an answer or a clear cut way to navigate it. It's just working through each thing as it comes.
Yeah. And I suppose the thing that like shouting out to me that would be really difficult there is almost when you have like gastrointestinal issues, when you're in recovery, you're told it will end. Yeah, you're told it's just because you're eating more than you're used to, and yeah, you know, your stomach will expand and it will get used to it and you'll be totally fine. Whereas, you know, actually that realization of, well, maybe this isn't just a recovery thing, you know, maybe I'm not just chronically tired, yeah, because I'm in recovery, you know, this is actually a condition that I now have and that I need to navigate. I can imagine that's difficult to come to that realization as well, that it's not something that's going to pass as recovery passes.
Absolutely. And I mean, I've recently had tests done with my gastro team that indicate that I do have issues, as in it's not just because I was restricting for so long, or I have actual genuine issues that are not going away on their own, and it's about management. And I've actually had to be referred to surgeons, and I don't know what that's going to look like. So that's like an uncertainty that's quite scary. But there is a part in my mind that wonders, had I not restricted for, you know, these periods of time in my life, you know, have I caused this? Have I made this worse? And then I start wondering, like, you know, have I made myself more unwell than I really would have been? And how helpful is that? Not very. But it's just me being honest, like, that is where my mind goes sometimes. How much damage have I caused my body, and kind of irreversible damage? So yeah, tricky. It's not going away with recovery. It's just another thing to balance. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think you're totally right. You know, I think so many people are not, I don't mean to say guilty of that, but like, so many people do that in terms of like, oh, if I hadn't had my eating disorder, would have this happened? Mm. Would I have impacted myself in this way? And, you know, I guess, like you said, there is really no way of knowing. And actually, it's looking at the here and now, and how can you manage the different things that are going on now. And I suppose for the listeners, if people are listening and, you know, they really resonate with what you're saying, how do you manage, you know, the different symptoms that you experience now?
So not a clear cut one, but I would say have as much support as you possibly can. So, I mean, I think the last time I counted, I'm under like 8 or 9 specialists at the moment. In addition to, I seek therapy for my mental health and the eating disorder side of things. And I think personally, I couldn't do one without the other. I need the support from the physical side. I need the support from the mental side, because the toll that having not just an eating disorder, but the chronic health stuff going on alongside it, it's too much. Like, I can't do it on my own. And I think it took a while for me to accept that, but I have now. And yeah, I would say try and address both at the same time, and make sure you've got, even aside from kind of therapists and healthcare professionals, try and have a really good support network around you, whether that's partner, friends, family, colleagues, whoever you've got there to support you. I think for me, really checking in with myself and doing that from a body and a mind place as well, not just one or the other. And just checking in with myself, seeing what do I need right now? What do I need today? Okay, I've got a migraine, so I need to take this medication and I need to rest. And this is what the food stuff needs to look like. Taking it really step by step, and not even a day at a time, but we're talking like half an hour at a time on those days where the symptoms are kind of extreme. I think self-compassion, and I'm really working on that one. I think a lot of us are in this world, but just really trying to monitor what my internal dialogue looks like. Am I being really critical? I should have done this. I should have done that. Or am I thinking, actually, I've done the best I can today with the symptoms that I've been faced with, and that is enough. Yeah. So they'd be like my top things for trying to manage.
Yeah, no, I think that's really helpful. I really like the thing that you said about self-compassion. And also, you know, a lot of people, like you corrected, they say take it day by day, and actually sometimes it is half an hour by half an hour. And I found with my own recovery and kind of, you know, getting the ADHD diagnosis, that some days certain things are really, they refuel me. So like going to see my friends or whatever would be something that refills my cup. But then equally other days, that's something that drains me. And the thing that I find so hard is, you don't really, like, how are you supposed to know? Like, everyone, I really like the spoon theory that people use, but equally I'm like, well, yeah, but some days, like going for a walk takes half a spoon, and other days it takes 15 spoons. Mm-hmm. Like, it's so difficult to know what activity is, how it's going to impact me each day. But I think you're so right, you know, just taking it each step at a time and being able to, you know, say, okay, it's okay actually that today that's taken more out of you, or then on other days, oh, maybe I feel like I can do a bit more, that's great. But really, I think I like that piece about, you know, having the compassion for yourself and not beating yourself up if things are harder one day than they are another.
Definitely. And I think that with chronic conditions, they are unpredictable. You don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I wake up tomorrow and need to spend half the day in bed, or whether I'm going to have a migraine, whether the pain's going to be so bad that actually going for a walk isn't even something I could consider. And I think something that I have found helpful when it comes to trying with the self-compassion is, how would I talk to a young child right now if I had a five-year-old? It could be five-year-old me, or if that doesn't feel like comfortable or right at the time, a five-year-old in front of me right now, and they were presenting with X, Y, and Z that you are dealing with right now. What would I say to them? What would I suggest? And actually, that's so helpful. And a therapist told me that years ago when I was at university, and that's always stuck with me as a real, like, a real golden piece of advice. So yeah, I try and go back to that when just trying to be self-compassionate on its own isn't really working. Let's just detach from maybe myself a little bit, and how would I do? How would I speak to a friend even right now? Yeah,
I think that's really, really helpful. I always do that. If I'm beating myself up about something, I'm like, okay, let's take a step back. Let's think about a friend that's going through this. What would you say to them? And it's always, you know, you're always so compassionate and caring and what have you, because you want what's best for them. And,
definitely.
You know, you can arguably know what's best for them as well. So I guess just to finish us off, you gave like really helpful tips on managing and stuff. But I was just thinking about, you know, if people have listened and then they're like, I think this is actually me and I do need to get some support for this. Are there any like organisations that you'd recommend, or I guess just general tips for going to the GP to kind of say, I think this is what's going on? Because, you know, I think one thing I found through going to the doctor, if you can go prepared with your own information, like there's like the beet leaflet, which you can take if you think you've got an eating disorder, that sort of thing. It kind of, it gives the doctor a leg up to say, ah, oh, okay, actually, yeah, I can help you with this as well.
Yeah, 100%. I always think going as best prepared with as much kind of like information or kind of evidence is the best way. But yeah, I mean, first port of call, always the GP. Go to the GP, discuss your concerns if you think you may have hypermobility or any other kind of condition. Obviously you need to explain why do you feel you have that, but look on the NHS website. Obviously GPs kind of in the UK will go by things on the NHS. NICE guidance is also another place to look at, although I'm not sure if that's a little bit too medical jargony for the general public. I'm not sure. Some may find that okay. There are organisations out there, and I can't think of kind of specific ones off the top of my head, but something personally I found really good is support groups on Facebook and even on Instagram. So I'm on a hypermobility spectrum disorder page. I'm on one for eating disorders as well. But for some of my specific issues, I've kind of sought out people that have the lived experience and can really kind of hold you when you need it, and probably in the best way that anybody could. Yeah, so support is out there. Groups are out there. They're, you know, you're not alone. The chances of you having something no one else is going through at all is very rare. So, yeah, it's just looking in the right places, but it is out there and it's relatively easy to access.
Yeah, I think that's a brilliant idea, actually, because I can imagine, particularly if you're, you know, putting the puzzle pieces together yourself and not 100% sure on how everything fits together, you know, speaking to individuals that have been there and kind of are going through it themselves, I can imagine that loneliness of not knowing what's going on could be quite difficult. So yeah, that's a brilliant idea. Well, thank you so much, Chloe. It's been such a pleasure to speak to you, and thank you so much for sharing your experience. Is there anywhere where people can go to find out more about you, or, you know, the work that you're doing to raise awareness of this topic?
So thank you so much for having me for a start. It's been a real pleasure. I have my Instagram page, which my handle will be on the info, won't it, of the podcast. Yeah. And that's a public account that people can access. That's pretty much where you can find me.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much. And best of luck with piecing all the jigsaw pieces together.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode. So be sure to subscribe. Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, but with the right support, they can be recovered from. We really hope you enjoyed this episode, but if you require more support right now, please look into charities such as First Steps and Beat for support, or talk to someone you trust.